When Diane Diekman was in college, she saw country music star Farron Young in concert. After the show, the singer wouldn't let her walk the 3 miles back to her dorm and insisted on taking her back in his tour bus. After graduating from college, she joined the Navy. She still attended his concerts whenever possible, and when he saw her, he'd salute. After his death, she feared Farron Young would be forgotten and decided to write his biography. And after finishing the Farron Young biography, Diane Diekman wrote a book about another member of the Country Music Hall of Fame, Marty Robbins, the multi-talented singer best known for the hits A White Sport Coat and A Pink Carnation and the timeless border tale El Paso. And Diane Diekman will be at the South Dakota State Fair on Friday before shows by regional country music star Sherwin Litton, and she's here at our studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And Diane, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Well, good afternoon, Carl. It's great to be here.
Well, I'd like to go back to that concert that I just mentioned when you saw Farron Young in college. How did that happen that you saw him after the show?
It was at the Coliseum downtown when they had the Hap People's Country shows, like one Tuesday a month, I think it was. And I usually went downtown for those while I was going to Augustana. So after the show, I would hang around and get the autographs from all the band members and everything. And I was talking to the band members and talking to Farron, and he told me to get in the bus and he'd give me a ride back to Augustana.
That must have been an amazing experience.
Oh, it was. It was quite a thrill.
Now, you'd been a Farron Young fan for some time before then. Was he someone that you grew up listening to?
Oh, I grew up listening to him, yes. But that concert was the first time I'd ever met him, the first time I'd seen him in person.
And what year was that?
That was 1970, St. Patrick's Day, 1970.
Oh. Well, for those of you who don't know Farron Young, let's listen to a little bit of a song that came, I think, maybe a couple of years after that, It's Four in the Morning. That was also around 72?
71, 72,
72.
Yes.
So this is a little bit of music of Farron Young. It's a song from Farron Young from the early 70s. It's Four in the Morning, and Farron Young is the subject of a biography written by Diane Diekman. That came out, what, about 2007?
It came out in hardcover in 2007. It was reissued in 2012 as a soft cover.
I'm always curious as to how someone starts writing a biography. Did you just decide, oh, I'm going to write a book about Farron Young and then just go out and interview people? How does that work?
Well, pretty much. When I decided I wanted to write his biography and I needed a career after retirement anyway, and I thought, well, I would enjoy writing books, and I decided his would be a good one to write and to be able to meet all the country singers that I'd grown up listening to, and everybody who knew Farron had stories to tell about him because he was such a character. So this was in 1999. I didn't know anything about publishing. I didn't have any contacts in the publishing industry or in the music industry. I didn't know anybody who knew Farron. I just decided I was going to do it. So one weekend, I bought a plane ticket and flew from Los Angeles, where I live, to Nashville to start looking up people to talk to them, and it went from there.
And how do you approach people? You say, hey, I'm writing a book about Farron Young, whether you're talking to, I imagine you have to talk to former bandmates, family members. Were they open to you, or I mean, how do you let them know that this is legitimate? You're not just some starstruck person who wants to meet country music performers.
At the beginning, of course, each time I did talk to somebody, and they were encouraging. Like Ralph Emery was one of the people I met the first weekend I was there, and he agreed to meet with me and talk to me, so I could always use his name after that. But in the beginning, when I had no publishing credits, I used my Navy captainness for credibility, and I I hope that people would think if somebody got as far as being a captain in the Navy, that it was someone who had some credibility and someone they could believe when I said I was going to follow through and write this book.
So once you got started, then, you know, you, Ralph Emery, then you interviewed someone that just kind of snowballed
yes,
from there.
It,
you were able
did.
To get other contacts. And
the more people I talked to, the more interviews I did, and someone would talk to someone else and say, should I talk to her? And somebody would say, well, yes, then, you know, she's doing a good job, or yes, she's somebody worth talking to. And eventually I probably made 1,000 phone calls or phone call attempts trying to get that done.
Were people more than happy to talk with you? Because when you're doing a biography, particularly someone like Farron Young, who had a very interesting life, some things maybe in the course of conversation that maybe people didn't maybe feel comfortable talking about, maybe some embarrassing things or things that didn't show Farron Young in the best light.
There were some people were hesitant and things that they wouldn't say, but I heard many stories that I was amazed that they would tell me the story. But in general, the attitude was, we're glad you're doing this. Farron's story should be told. There needs to be a book about him. People, we don't want him forgotten. People agreed with me on that. And in general, everybody was really favorable and forthcoming. There was one band member who at first told me he wouldn't talk to me. He wanted to keep his thoughts, his memories private. And several years later, I called him up to ask him a specific question about clarifying a fact, and he just started talking. And after that, I mean, he told me all kinds of stories to put in the book, because he'd come around to the idea that I guess he thought he realized he could trust me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Farron Young, born in Louisiana in 1932, and as I understand it, he was one of these guys who just grew up singing?
He did.
Grew up on a dairy farm?
Right. From the time he was a little boy, that's what his brother and sisters remembered about him. They said Farron was always singing, and he was a family of six kids, and that they didn't have much money, and his dad worked on dairy farms, and they would move from one farm to the other. And his dad was not physically abusive from what I know, but verbally abusive at least. So he grew up without a good relationship with his father. And I think it always bothered him. And the fact that he wasn't very tall, he was always trying to prove himself. He always had to be the big man, you know, pick the fights and show how macho he was.
When did he decide to make music a career? Or maybe it wasn't something you just decide. Maybe it's something that just happens, that you have the talent and people recognize it.
When he was in high school, he and Teddy Wilburn of the Wilburn Brothers were high school classmates, and they would play music in school and such, and Farron would go around town with different gigs. So, no, he started performing while he was in high school, and that's what he wanted to do, was have a singing career and be on the Grand Ole Opry. He said that he would sing to the cows, and he would introduce himself as the star of the Grand Ole Opry as he was singing to the cows.
And when did his career really start to come together? Was that in the early 50s? You listen to some of those early records, it sounds like he was very much inspired by Hank Williams.
Oh, he was, yes. Hank Williams was his idol, and that was the time. It was 51 when Farron got on the Louisiana Hayride with Webb Pierce and signed his contract and went to Nashville in the spring of 52. And so, of course, that's why Hank Williams was really big, and right before he died, and then Farron got drafted into the Army the end of 52. But while he was in the Army, he still had his recording contract such and did a lot of performing.
Was it difficult for him to get a recording contract?
No. He was singing on the radio one afternoon and Ken Nelson from Capitol Records was out looking for people to sign to the label, and he heard Farron singing on the radio, so he tracked him down and offered him a contract, and then he also put him in touch with Hubert Long, who did management, and asked Hubert to sign him as a manager. So Farron stayed with Ken Nelson as his producer and Hubert Long as his manager for like 12 years.
And what was the environment? I'm curious as how he was able to continue a career while he was in the service.
Well, Going Steady, his first release, went to number 2 on the Billboard chart, his debut song, and that happened while he was in basic training. So the Army took advantage of this. In early 1953, they needed somebody to replace Eddie Fisher, who was the Special Services recruiting singer. And when Eddie Fisher got out of the Army, then they gave Farron the job. So it was his job to go around performing and encouraging people to join the Army. So that's what he did for his 2 years service. Was he was in special services and he would do Army recruiting shows.
And what was you mentioned some of the stories that people were telling. You know, this is really what the late 50s, early 60s. I don't know if you'd call it the peak years of his fame, but you know, to give us an idea of what he was like, how important he was in the country music scene at that time.
Well, this was the early 50s, and then when he went back to Nashville and he built his career. So, and by the 60s, he was well-known. He was also a businessman in Nashville. He started the Music City News magazine, and then the Music City News Awards, which eventually became televised, and the TNN Country Music Awards that were fan-voted awards. So Farron started that. And he also started, he and several people got together and built a racetrack, Sulphur Hills, I think it was. It was an old baseball diamond, and they turned it into a car racetrack, and it wasn't very, it didn't work out very well. But then, and also with golf, he started the golf tournaments in Nashville. So he had publishing companies and such. So he helped a lot of people, such as Willie Nelson, get started in the music business. And he was quite a force in music and business in Nashville.
Now you mentioned Willie Nelson. One of the songs that first really made Willie Nelson's reputation was a big hit for Farron Young, and that was Hello Walls. And if we have that, I'd like to hear a little bit of Hello Walls.
Hello, walls. How'd things go for you today? Don't you miss her? Since she upped and walked away, and I'll bet you dread to spend another lonely night with me. Only walls, I'll keep you company. Hello, window.
That's music of Farron Young, possibly his best-known record, Hello Walls, from the early 1960s, a song by Willie Nelson. I want to be able to talk with Marty about Marty Robbins in just a few minutes, but later in his career, things started. What Farron Young felt like he wasn't appreciated anymore late in his life.
Well, that happens with most of the older singers. The record companies put their money onto the new upcoming one. So, Farron's last big hits were in the early 70s, and he continued recording throughout the 70s and into the late 80s, but didn't have any. any hit success. And then he pretty much retired from the music business in about 1993. But one of the things that I uncovered through my research, or my conclusion anyway, is that he suffered from depression his entire life, and nobody really recognized that. And he, of course, tried to hide it, overcome it, compensate for it. But when he committed suicide in 1996, everybody was so shocked that nobody figured that Farron Young, of all people, would have ever done anything like that. And what I found out from learning about depression and such is that it was a logical end for him, because particular men who suffer from depression so often try to overcome it, because a macho man is not supposed to be depressed. So alcoholism and being violent and being a daredevil and being mouthy and getting in fights and all that kind of stuff that Farron did so well and so was so good at could have been in a way that he was trying to convince himself that he was okay. But anyway, so what I realized from writing it is it wasn't a surprise for him to commit suicide. He'd sent out plenty of signals to people over the years, and particular towards the end, and nobody got it. It just seemed so unlike him. He'd covered it up so well all those years that people didn't expect that.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. We're talking with author and retired Navy Captain Diane Diekman. She's written two biographies of country music legends, Farron Young and Marty Robbins. And coming up after a short break, we'll talk some more. Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. We're continuing our conversation with Sioux Falls author and retired Navy Captain Diane Diekman. She's written a couple of books about two members of the Country Music Hall of Fame, Farron Young and Marty Robbins. The Marty Robbins book is called 20th Century Drifter, The Life of Marty Robbins. And this was a book you started thinking about while you're working on the Farron Young biography?
Yes, I did. I was watching a TV show one day. It was a Marty Robbins Spotlight TV show because Farron was his guest on it. And watching it, it just hit me. What an amazing talent Marty Robbins was. And I'd always been a Marty Robbins fan. I always enjoyed his music. And I thought, well, I don't think his biography has been written yet. And the same decision I had to make with Farron was, this someone that I would get tired of? Would I never get tired of talking about this person, listening to his music? And I decided, yeah, I could do Marty Robbins. So I started on his biography next. And it was a lot easier the second time, because then I had credibility.
Yeah, you had the connections.
I did.
I had a book out. Marty Robbins might be a little bit better known than Farron Young. He was on the pop charts with things like Singin' the Blues, A White Sport Coat and A Pink Carnation, and El Paso. Marty Robbins was he sang anything.
Oh,
almost
he could do any kind of music. He was also interested in a lot of music. I've heard people say that Marty must have known 1,000 songs, that they could name any song and he could sing at least a few lines of whatever song somebody came up with. So he was just, music was so in him and so important to him. He could sing any of it.
Now, before we talk a little bit more about Marty Robbins, we should hear a little bit of him. And if we have this queued up, I'd like to hear a little bit of Devil Woman.
I told Mary about us. I told her about our great sin. Mary cried and forgave me. And Mary took me back again. Said if I wanted my freedom, I could be free evermore. But I don't want to be, and I don't want to see Mary cry anymore. Oh, devil woman, let go of me, devil woman.
That's Marty Robbins, a hit from the 1960s, Devil Woman, with that wonderful little falsetto leap there. Yeah. Wonderful voice. Now, Marty Robbins, that was not his real name.
No, his name is Martin David Robinson. And that's how he grew up. And then when he was starting his musical career in Phoenix, then he thought, well, Martin David Robinson, that's too long a name to be on a jukebox. It wouldn't fit in the space allotted for a name. And a friend suggested that he change his name to Marty Robbins. And he liked that idea, and he did. He never legally changed his name, but that's the name he was always known by.
Now, Marty Robbins' career, the roots go back to World War II when he was in the Navy. And I guess that's something maybe that was very much of an interest to you because you were in the Navy.
Well, that was one of the considerations when deciding to write his biography, besides the fact that he was a country singer whom I loved his music. He also had the Navy background, which interested me, the combat in the South Pacific, and the NASCAR. And I had some background and knowledge in NASCAR. I thought that would be interesting to research. So it was the Navy and NASCAR, in addition to as being a singer, that got me interested in writing it.
Yeah, he was a race car driver.
Yes.
I'm wondering, in comparison to Farron Young seemed to be a fairly troubled person. Marty Robbins, at least his public persona wasn't so much that way, but once you dug a little deeper, what'd you find out about Marty Robbins?
They had a lot of similarities. They both had this poor father figure, poor connection, so they went through life trying to prove themselves, sort of. But I think they both needed attention. And the way I put it is, Farron just wanted attention. He didn't care whether it was good or bad, just so he got attention. Well, Marty needed positive attention. He needed approval. He was a perfectionist, and everything he did had to be done correctly. So he was always striving for things to be done right and to look well. But they were both very much performers, and they needed the feedback and they needed the attention.
And what, when you were talking with Marty Robbins' band members, what did they say about him as far as the way that he would lead a group or how he would perform and how he'd put a show together?
All the consummate professional. I had trouble finding anything negative about Marty because he held his image so tightly, and you know, with Farron it was easy, and he proudly talked about all the trouble he got into and all that, and his band members took pride in being a partying band, so they all enjoyed talking about getting drunk and the women and the trouble and all that kind of stuff, whereas Marty was a stickler for the proper image. And I had to ask leading questions about Marty, and the most I could come up with was that he had a hot temper. And so apparently he would chew people out undeservedly or not, I don't know, but he had these high standards and he expected people to live up to them. And of course, being in that industry, you know, there's all the women all the time. Well, Marty had his band rallied around him and supported him. And I asked a couple of the old timers about the women on the road and all that kind of stuff. And one of them says, "You know better than to ask me a question like that. You know I'm not going to answer that." You know, those kinds of things. So everybody, their opinion of Marty was that he was a stickler for his rules, but he was a wonderful person to work for. Everybody liked him. It was, like I said, difficult to find anything less than positive because everybody thought he was so wonderful.
He had some health problems. He was fairly young when he had a heart attack.
In fact, the first heart attack was undiagnosed. It happened, as he figured out later, while he was racing, doing a NASCAR race in 1968. And he just thought he had indigestion or something. Well, then he had his major heart attack, his first major heart attack in 69, which led to his heart bypass surgery in 1970. But at that time, they found scar tissue on his heart. And then he realized, well, a year before, when he was racing this car, that had been his first heart attack. And he had two heart attacks after that. So it was the fourth heart attack, although it's most people think it's the third heart attack, but it was actually the fourth one that killed him.
And that was, what, 82?
82, December 82.
Right after he was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Yes, inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in October. And he said, well, you know, there's people who deserve it before I do, but I don't know if they'll ever give it to me again, so I better take it while I can. And then he ran another race car, or another NASCAR race in November, and then a month later hit his final heart attack.
Now, Dan Diekman, I understand, we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, that you've written more than just these two books. You've written some books about your own experiences. And before we go here in a couple of minutes, you'll be at the State Fair on, that's Friday.
On Friday.
As part of the Sherwin-Linton show.
Yes.
So you'll be talking about your books, you're telling stories, or, I mean, you're not singing.
No, I'm not singing. No, Sherwin's performing on the Centennial stage. He has shows at 11, 2, and 4. And before each one of his shows, I'll be up there for like 10, 15 minutes talking about my books, the stories of growing up on a farm in Dual County and my career in the Navy. And then I'll talk about writing Farron's biography, and I'll talk about writing Marty's biography.
What's been the response since these books have come out from the people that knew Farron Young and Marty Robbins, some of the people you talked to?
They all say, well, gee, I learned a whole lot about him that I didn't know. Well, I would hope so. I would hope there's, you know, I've found things that nobody else knew. But the kids, Farron's kids, Robin and Alana, it meant a lot to me to have them tell me that they learned so much, and they appreciated what they learned, and they realized that growing up with the abusive parent that Farron was, that it wasn't their fault because he had always been like that. And for them, it helped them understand him better.
And this is probably not a very good question when you only have 30 seconds to go, but Farron Young and Marty Robbins, do you think their legacy, musical legacies, continue?
Oh, yes.
That they won't be forgotten?
No, and now with the wonders of YouTube, where anybody can hear any song they want, I think when people are curious enough to look them up and listen to their music, they'll just realize how great they are.
And you have a website as well to find out more about these books and your other books, and that's DianeDiekman.com.
Yes.
All right. Well, Diane Diekman, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday again.
I really appreciate being invited. I've enjoyed it.
And that's it for this edition of Dakota Midday. Thanks to all of our guests on today's show. The producer of Dakota Midday is Stephen Swemke. We had assistance from Nathan Poole. Special thanks to Kara Hetland and Keila Boltina for their help here at the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Coming up tomorrow, South Dakota Agriculture Secretary Lucas Lech joins the show, and we'll talk with State Senator Dan Lederman, who's back from the Toll Fellowship Leadership Program. That's all coming up tomorrow at noon Central, 11 Mountain, right here on SDPB Radio. I'm Carl Gerke. Stay tuned. Here and Now is coming up next.
Big iron on his hip. Big iron, big iron. When he tried to match the ranger with the big iron on his hip, big iron on his hip.